So this evening, I thought, and I'm deliberately using that word, I thought we would talk about thought and thinking, and maybe not completely in the usual way, although I am going to follow the some of the texts where the Buddha talks about this in particular. I think a lot of people want to know how to deal with thought. And this isn't just something that we have at the beginning of practice when we sit down and we have usually the very first insight that we have is, wow, my mind is really out of control. I had no idea. And there you go, that's the first insight. But really, all along the path, there are aspects of the thinking mind that we keep discovering because this is a very rich part of our experience of being human, is to have a cognitive mind, thinking mind, to use language, to need to use organization and logic in various ways. And that's almost all just the surface part of the thinking mind. And then it goes even deeper into intentions, into various kinds of investigations that we can do from a meditative state that are still using that part of the mind. So in a way, we're always wanting to know, we're always wanting to or needing to relate to this aspect of experience. In fact, I would say you have to have some relationship to the thinking mind on the spiritual path. But I've noticed that often, kind of at the, again, at the top level, spiritual teachings tend to be fairly negative about the thinking mind. Either we have our own ideas, oh, I have too many distracting thoughts, I just want them all to go away, etc. Or we've been told that thinking is the antithesis of love and wisdom and all the good things that we want on the path have nothing to do with thinking. And when we meditate, maybe we even have the idea that we should have a blank mind or, fewer thoughts is better. Or we even do this kind of subconsciously where we would say, oh, I had a great meditation. My mind was so calm and happy the whole time, as if it can't be a great meditation if there's anything else happening. So, all these ways in which we're subtly disparaging the thinking mind. So I'm not here to tell you that, in fact, thinking is really great and important for the path, but it is more nuanced than that. And the Buddha's teachings about the thinking mind and about how to work with thought are nuanced, actually. The aversion that we tend to carry to thinking, especially thinking that happens during sitting, guess what? It's aversion. And aversion, we know, is definitely obstructing to our path. Yeah. So there's some subtlety there. We can start by noting that thinking is a natural function of the human mind. Buddhist teachings actually don't say to end all thought as a prerequisite to practice. But, like other traditions, the Buddhist teachings do say that awakening has nothing to do with cognitive understanding. But nonetheless, there are valid uses of thought in Buddhist practice. And also, thought is just one more thing to be understood, the process of thinking and how it can be helpful. Because it can. I'll mention some things later. And of course, how it can be harmful, how it entangles us or distances us from reality or leads in directions that are not helpful. So all of that is good. There's a series, it turns out, a series of three suttas in a row that Bhikkhu Sujato, one of the major translators of the suttas, he's called them the Thought Trilogy. And it might be that other teachers or monastics call them that too. I just hadn't heard it before. So at least he does. Maybe others do. And it's true that together these three nicely go through the complexity and nuance of this aspect of the mind. I don't think we're going to get through all three completely. In fact, we're not. But let's start and talk a little bit, talk our way through some of them. So these three are suttas 18, 19, and 20 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And the first one of them is called the Honeyball Sutta, which is great, right? Starts us off with a nice, appealing sounding name, the Honeyball Sutta. And I suspect that at least some of you have heard of this before or studied it before. And yet, I find each time I go through it, there's more there. It's one of those ones that just has so much richness to it. And it starts right out with an interesting beginning. So there's a Brahmin who comes to see the Buddha while he's meditating in the forest. And it says this Brahmin is out walking for exercise, and he comes up to the Buddha while he's sitting. And this Brahmin's name is Dandapani. And the name means carrying a stick, carrying a stick. The funny thing, though, is that the commentaries about Dandapani say that his character was that he was actually a young Brahmin, relatively young, but he liked to walk around with a golden walking stick, as if he needed a walking stick while he was walking. But it was really kind of ostentation that he was carrying this golden walking stick. And so he was known for being a little bit ostentatious and arrogant in certain ways. But I think carrying a stick also refers to his somewhat combative nature. So overall, this is not the kind of person that you really want to have a conversation with. But he comes up to the Buddha and he says to him in kind of a, arrogant tone, he says, it says he stood to one side, leaning on his stick, and asked the Blessed One, "What does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim?" So you can imagine this scene, right? And the Buddha was peacefully meditating. And so he decides, he sizes up Dandapani and suspects that this is not really a sincere question. And so he answers him kind of a little bit on a tangent, and he says, "Friend," that's nice, he calls him friend. He says, "Friend, I assert and proclaim my teaching in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world." And so he doesn't answer what he proclaims, he answers how he teaches. And he says, he teaches in such a way that it doesn't conflict with anyone. And so the text says that Dandapani was taken aback by this and furrowed his brow. I think it even says he stuck out his tongue. Yeah, he wagged his tongue and raised his eyebrows. I'm not sure what that means. But essentially, he didn't find anything to argue with there, and so was a little confused by that and left. So he didn't get to benefit from the Buddha's teaching at all. But sometime later, the Buddha told the monks, like that evening he mentioned that he had had this encounter with Dandapani, and one of the bhikkhus raised his hand and says, "Well, could you expound on that a little bit? What is it that you meant by, you teach without conflicting with anyone?" And the Buddha had actually gone on and said, "I teach in such a way that perceptions no more underlie that person who abides detached from sensual pleasures without perplexity, shorn of worry, and free from craving for any kind of being." So that's a pretty puzzling statement, but he essentially says that he doesn't have certain underlying perceptions that are going to lead his mind into long thought trails. This is a sutta about papancha, which some of you may be familiar with. It's that when the mind gets caught up in a long thought trail, discursive thought, just feeding on itself, not really about the present moment anymore. I don't know if any of you have ever had this experience. I've certainly had this experience. So the Buddha alludes very, very subtly. You're not supposed to understand that statement that he the cryptic statement he made to the fact that the mind has some underlying tendencies in it that are what allow it to get drawn in to these thought trails. So that might be interesting to us to consider. What is it that's lying dormant in the mind that is allowing it to get stuck? Because we often don't see that moment, right? We think we're sitting peacefully with the breath or the body. And maybe we do that for a little while and then suddenly we're thinking about something. How did that happen? Turns out that it's not only that mindfulness fell away, although it might have a little bit, but we have underlying tendencies in the mind that have basically Velcro or little hooks on them. And if thoughts come along with just the right counter hook, they'll connect. And so part of practice is to train the mind such that it doesn't have these hooks on it that are such that the mind gets easily hooked. That's what this sutta is about at its base. How do you not, how do you let go of the tendency toward thought trails? And you might say, well, how does that come about in relation to this carrying stick, combative kind of guy? And the Buddha says, when he explains to the monks what he was talking about, he says, well, let me tell you the source of where these perceptions that underlie in the mind come from. And if nothing is found there to delight in, then we would have the end of these underlying tendencies and also the end of resorting to rods and weapons, quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. So he says that he makes kind of a dramatic statement that the tendency of the mind to get caught up in thought and just run off on its own ideas, if that is taken to its extreme, that is the cause of war and quarrels and disputes and brawls and malicious words and all of that. Do you agree with that? I see a few nods. You don't necessarily have to know for sure, but it's an interesting prospect, right? So worth considering at least. So the Buddha is really going to talk about thought and why it is that we wander off during meditation, but he gives us this little tantalizing application of this. And the reason you would care about this, he says, is because this is the root of many, many problems in the world, including presumably wandering around and asking cheeky, arrogant questions to a monk meditating in the forest. Why would you just walk up and ask him a kind of a somewhat nasty question like that? So he's implying this guy's mind is doing this. I didn't bite, but if someone did, there could have been a fight. Okay, so having said all of that as kind of a tantalizing beginning, the Buddha teases the monks yet further, and he turns around and walks into his kuti and closes the door after giving them this very profound and large, broad-reaching statement. And the monks look at each other and they say, "Did you get that? No. Did you get that? No." So they decide together that they didn't really understand what the Buddha was talking about with. You have these underlying tendencies that lead the mind into proliferating its own ideas. And if it goes too far, that's why we get into conflicts. And so, and this subtle statement also, if you have these tendencies, if there's nothing there that you attach to, that you found to delight in, it won't happen. That process is interrupted. So they go to a different monk, a wise, Arahant monk. And they say, "Could you explain what the Buddha said?" So this is Mahakacchana. And he says, "Yeah, I can. I can tell you what he meant there in a little bit more detail. I can unfold it." So I think we won't go through this in super detail, but essentially, Mahakacchana, instead of trying to explain the external part about the war and why all that happens in the world, he goes inward and he says, "I'm going to tell you about moment by moment what happens in the cognitive process when the mind gets caught up before all the other stuff erupts in the world." And so he gives them a little sequence and he says, this is also meant to be a little cryptic. says, dependent on the I and forms, I consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, one perceives. What one perceives, one thinks about. What one thinks about, one mentally proliferates. And then, with what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset that person with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable by the eye. And then it goes on to the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind. The mind, too, is a source. So I know that sounds like, wow, I didn't want to know all of that. But essentially, it's a sequence that sounds a little bit like dependent arising, right? It's like there's a contact, that's part of dependent arising. Something comes in all the time. We're having experiences, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. Right now you're hearing my voice and you're cognizing something about it because you can understand the language. Stuff's coming in and you're conscious of something, you're paying attention to something there. And he says, dependent on this, there's a feeling tone. All right, it's pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neither. Whether or not you're aware of that, there is that registering going on our system. Why? Because we're sensitive beings. Things come in. There's not, everything isn't just neutral. There's like we, there's things that are pleasant, things that are unpleasant, things that are painful, things that are enjoyable. Don't tell me how it is right now for you with what you're, but it comes in and then we perceive something about that. We cognize it. We put it in some box in our mind. Oh, this is interesting. Or, oh, I don't get it. Or, oh, my knee is hurting. I wonder if I can get up and get a cold pack for it. Little things like that are going on all the time. And we're making decisions about how to move around our environment. And sometimes we start thinking, like the thing about the knee, and we say, oh, is that going to be okay? I guess so. The little thing that starts going on, and then we start proliferating on that. Well, it's hurting more today than it did yesterday, and maybe I should go get acupuncture for that tomorrow. I don't know if I could get in though. And so, pretty, I don't know, I'm making this up, but pretty soon the mind is, you realize you haven't heard what was going on for the last 5 or 10 seconds. So this is natural. The mind will go off like this. But he uses this lovely phrase that perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset that person with respect to past, future, and present. So we get burdened by the past, some memory we get caught up in. Oh, that happened yesterday. I shouldn't have said that. Oh, maybe I can make up for it. Maybe tomorrow I can talk with that person. Suddenly, like we're no longer in this time and place anymore. So this word beset, does that sound like it applies? Yeah, we get beset by things, and it feels suddenly like it's coming from somewhere else, like the stuff is just happening to us. But the beginning of this was just that there's a contact, and then we started to think about it. So Samanhokachana kind of unfolds this, and I've in we don't need to go into the details of whether we've unpacked all of that in our own practice. But look what's being said, which is that papancha emerges from the cognitive process itself in the presence of something like delight and attachment, which could be wanting and it could be also pushing away, not wanting. So there's a cognitive process going on of we experience comes in and we have to perceive it somehow and we have to do something with it. That's what we're doing all day. That's what it is to be human, is to receive input, process it, and do something with it. That's a lot of what our life is about. But he says, there's a, so we're not going to get rid of that. We're not going to stop that part of living, but we have to see the moment where the mind grabs on. That's where we get beset. That's where the mind takes off. It leaves the present moment. It turns it into its own cognitive creation instead of still interacting and connecting with the environment of what's going on. So, what's the solution to this? The solution offered in this sutta, just the first of the three on the Thought Trilogy, is to have clear mindfulness of this process such that we're not fooled by the unfolding process. It says, if nothing there is found to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to get caught up. And it takes some mental development to do that. So I'm not saying this is easy, but Kachana says go backwards, go deeper into looking at the details of the process. And it doesn't, it's not expected that we would have all of that exactly clearly understood moment by moment. But I do want to say it's possible. It's possible to watch that sequence unfold, sometimes in a deep sit at home and also on retreat or in a day long even. Maybe you'll get to see some of the sequence. There was an announcement about a day long coming up on Transcendent Dependent Arising, which is very similar to Dependent Arising, except it goes to a better place. And there, too, you're looking at a sequence that unfolds bit by bit, a natural process of the mind. So I encourage you maybe to attend that day long and get used to seeing how the mind goes step by step through these things like contact, feeling, and then what the mind does with that. But a natural question, maybe after studying this text or after hearing this description of how the mind gets itself caught up and then can even go as far as war, we might say, okay, but how does one practice such that this tendency is reduced? We're not going to stop thinking. So what else do we need to know about thought such that we don't go into this delight and welcoming and holding? This is all nice, abstract. You've laid it all out great, but what do I actually do? What's the practice that goes with that? And very nicely, Majjhima Nikaya 19, the following sutta, gets more practical, and it talks about how we can actually start to relate to the thinking process such that we're going to be able to differentiate what's helpful and what's not helpful in thinking. So in Majjhima Nikaya 19, which is called Two Kinds of Thought, the Buddha talks about a time before his awakening, when he was just an unenlightened bodhisattva, yes, he says, and how he was practicing at that time. Well, my ears prick up at that. I want to know what the Buddha was doing before his awakening. That sounds helpful for me. So he says, before my enlightenment, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I said on one side, thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I said on the other side, thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. So there we go. Two classes, one wholesome, one unwholesome, each one divided into three types that complement each other, let's say. And these ones that are non-ill will and non-cruelty, sometimes people like to say the positive form of those, like non-ill will is goodwill or metta. Non-cruelty could be compassion, care. You can choose what works for you. We're going to be doing some thoughts of metta later, so we'll get to practice with that category. But there's some very important things that the Buddha says about dividing his thoughts. And I also want to note that he did make this choice deliberately about these. I haven't read it yet, but he says very clearly one of these classes is helpful, one of these classes is not helpful. So sometimes people have the idea that when you sit in mindfulness, there should be no judgment of anything. Everything is just equal. Everything is the same. It's all the Dharma. My job is to just sit with anything that arises and be with it. And that's the only instruction. That's a good instruction. It's a good place to start. It's not the only mode to practice in. And judiciousness, that is, knowing what's helpful and not helpful, is not the same as judgment. So we don't judge the thoughts in the sense of, oh, I shouldn't have thought that. That's not a spiritual thought, or I shouldn't be thinking at all. How come my mind isn't blank, etc. But it is very skillful to know if your thought is wholesome or unwholesome at a given moment. Don't turn that into a judgment of yourself. Oh, bad. I shouldn't have this. I'm an angry person for having that angry thought. Never mind. But you can say that is a thought of ill will. Wow. Okay. Next thought might be a thought of goodwill or a thought of letting go. But that was a thought of ill will. I saw you. I saw that. We should see that. We should make that distinction. I don't think it's possible to walk a spiritual path if you refuse to make any distinctions about what's helpful and what's not. So, how did the Buddha make this distinction? So he says, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire or ill will or cruelty arose in me. Let's pick ill will. A thought of ill will arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of ill will has arisen in me. So, just a statement of fact. Then he goes on, though. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana. So he doesn't say it's all fine. He says this is not helpful. This leads away from nibbana. This leads to difficulties, all kinds of stuff. So, and then he says very helpfully, when I considered thus, that thought subsided in me. I don't know that it's always quite that simple, but there is at least the possibility that if we see a thought and we see it really clearly and we look it squarely in the eye and we say, that is not helpful, that leads away from what I'm interested in, which is freedom. It might back off and subside. That can happen, actually. If we're very clear with it, without aversion, there isn't any aversion in what he said, just a statement of fact. And so, he then realizes, oh, and then we have the famous statement you've probably heard, whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of ill will, they have abandoned the thought of goodwill to cultivate the thought of ill will and so forth, and their mind will incline toward ill will. So we're always practicing something. We're always practicing something. And in this case, we understand, oh, if I keep practicing ill will, I'm just going to get more of that. So he then realizes this is not helpful. But he then goes to the other class. He describes also that sometimes we see thoughts that are actually helpful. And this also has some surprising aspects to it. So he says, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of goodwill arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of goodwill has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nibbana. How about that? A thought of goodwill leads to nibbana. Thought can lead to nibbana. Thought can aid wisdom. It can. Good thoughts are helpful. So then he says, if I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. So helpful thoughts are fine. And in the same way, whatever we frequently think and ponder upon, that becomes the inclination of the mind. So thinking and pondering on goodwill, on compassion, on letting go and freedom, it's all fine. But the Buddha is a little careful and he does add a little caveat and says, but with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from concentration. So I quieted my mind. So this was during meditation, right? So he did realize that, okay, so good thoughts, there's nothing to worry about there. But if you do too much of it, if you're thinking good, even if they're good, you might get tired. That's what I pointed to at the very end of the sitting. Is it possible just to relax with thoughts, even if they're good? They can be tiring. So this is something people often discover on retreat, by the way, is I know you're tired on the first day of retreat because it takes so much effort just to get on retreat and everybody falls asleep in the hall the first day. But by the third or fourth day, that's not really happening in the same way. But people then discover more subtly that their mind is exhausted from having thought so much. Just all that thinking. It's not unusual for people to come into a practice discussion and say, I had no idea my mind was so exhausted from, 5 decades of thinking. It's true. It's true. So then the Buddha says, well, so then I decided to concentrate the mind and allow the process to continue. But there's something sweet about this, right? He didn't just sit down and say, all right, I got to stop all the thoughts and get concentrated. Got to meditate well. Got to turn the mind off. He goes through a process where he sees what his mind is doing. He looks at the content. Is it wholesome or unwholesome? And then as soon as he knows that, he switches to looking at the process and he realizes this is not leading in the right direction. It will not go toward nibbana, or this is leading in the right direction. It is supporting wisdom, but it might tire me out. So he looks at the content just enough to see helpful or not helpful. Then he switches to the process, has a wisdom understanding of the process, and then he can settle the mind. I would suggest it works that way for us. It's very hard to just sit down and let go of thinking. It is helpful to look at what's going on with it, just briefly. Know that it's not, it is or is not in line with your aim and practice. I assume most of us are not wanting to sit down and cultivate cruelty and ill will in the mind or, sensual desire. Not that all desire is bad, but this is, what kind it's referring to. And so, having some understanding about that. And then he, I want to wind up so we have time for a couple of questions, but I think I'll wind up by saying really understanding the thinking mind, seeing it clearly, and not buying into it is what both of these suttas end up saying in the end. One of them in a very, I don't want to say abstract exactly, but it's just a very detailed way in the honey ball with all the different steps. And also, and then in a, maybe a more general way. In Lajjha Manikaya 19, the two kinds of thought. But in both cases, we're meant to just see, like, what's the mind doing? Is it going in a good direction? If it's not, finding a way to release that and not getting upset about either direction, because that would be adding aversion. That'd be adding more judgment, more thought. So judiciousness without judgment allows us to not be fooled by the normal activity of the mind. We're not going to stop our mind from operating, but don't be fooled by where it goes. And then you won't run off into getting into a conflictive way of being, like Dandapani, or even farther, all the way to war. So, yeah, I'll stop there and see if there are any questions or comments at this point, or thoughts, let's say. Oh, there's Patty. Patty, go ahead.
Hi, I have a sort of meta question about the sutta itself. That was the
Okay.
first time I ever heard a sutta in which someone else explained what the Buddha meant, where the monks were confused and someone else came in and had to straighten them out. Is that
Yeah.
common? That's the first time I remember hearing that.
Oh, that's a good question. It's not super common. But this particular monk, Mahakachana, who they asked, was actually named as the monk who was the most skilled at expounding in detail what somebody else had said in brief. Believe it or not, that was an epithet he was given by the Buddha, and he was an arahant, so everything he was saying, he was very clear on it. So that happens in many of the suttas that Mahakacchana teaches, which is a handful. I think it's probably less than 10. Don't quote me on that number exactly. And there's a few other cases also where somebody else explains. Like there's one where Ananda does that. There's one of the nuns does that. But it's not super common. So.
Thank you, and thank you for the good advice on thinking. It was very helpful. Thank
Great.
you.
I have a question, Kim.
Yes,
Well,
Isabel.
hi.
Hi.
I mean, not really a qu question so much as a comment that I feel like the more I meditate, the less I have discursive thinking, and I'm guessing that there's some type of, I don't know, mystical way that the mind begins to relax on its own, and there's a hey, sorry, doggy mistake. Sorry, no. Anyway, so I'm just wondering if you can comment on that, because I feel like I love the talk, actually. That's one of my favorite suttas because it makes so much sense. But then oftentimes I wonder if, that's not as much talked about. Just the fact that meditation calms everything down so much that there is so much less, and it always seems to happen in some mystical way, that you one day wake up and realize, wow, I'm just not thinking as much and I'm not stressing as much. And it's because the more meditation, it's that old saying about meditation, how, meditation doesn't make you enlightened, but meditation makes you accident prone, and you accidentally end up getting, I'm screwing up the whole comment, but anyway, you get my point. I'm gonna take your answer offline.
I appreciate this
I'm
comment.
here, so yep.
Okay. I appreciate this. In that, yeah, the mind does naturally settle and there will be less of the discursive thinking, but it's still possible to observe. In fact, when the mind is quiet, we can go into observing this sequence that Mahakacchana pointed out. Can we see that there's contact? It has a feeling tone. We perceive something about it. We conceptualize in some way, knowing what it is. And then there can be thought about that or not. We can start to discern different layers or levels, different kinds of thought. I've certainly noticed that the discursive thinking or the surface level, when that quiets down, there's then another level that's a little bit like commentary, not blah, blah, blah commentary, but neutral commentary, like the mind seems fairly settled now, or maybe I should switch from the breath to the body. Just like things that are actually about the meditation itself. Those too are arising due to a contact, a feeling tone, a perception of understanding. That we're in meditation and we can have a comment about that. So, and then there are even yet more subtle thoughts than that, that when that commentary or guidance layer falls away, there are still little ones that come in, such as the small intention that moves us from the first to the second jhana, for example. That's an inclination of the mind that could be called a thought. It's like a wish toward quieting. And then the mind might shift. So, learning more and more about what is the cognitive mind, where does the part that we would call thinking stop, and still something underneath that's not really thinking but has that flavor, has that directive flavor. So, I'm giving you maybe more than you pointed to, but I'd say. There's an enjoyment of the quiet that's good enough, and there's more investigation to be done also. Thanks, I see the heart.